It was all the more potent a reminder of how intensely boring the man was, since she was not the high-powered lobbyist she pretended to be, but a Sector 9, no, People's Protectorate agent. Her entire life had been spent humoring assets and marks, and the difficulty she'd experienced with Farrell spoke volumes of the inanity of the man's seemingly endless drivel. Tried for years to organize my colleagues to deal with... Excuse me, Senator, I'm sorry to interrupt. But if I don't, odds are I'm going to kill you and throw your body in the river. But I'm afraid I have a rather pressing engagement elsewhere, one I cannot miss, as much as I wish we could continue this discussion. That's a pity, Desiree. I was about to suggest we might extend our conversation over dinner. I know of a very quiet spot not far from here. They have the most amazing... I'm devastated that I must decline for now, Senator. As much as I would prefer to continue enjoying your company, sadly, work calls. I just wanted to get this latest package to you today, and I felt I needed to hand it to you directly. Thank you, Desiree. You are most kind and conscientious. I understand the plight of your clients on Danith, and I can promise you action. Quickly. She smiled and nodded, though she suspected her definition of quickly and Farrell's differed significantly. She reached out, putting her hand on the senator's arm and holding it there for a moment. The gesture wasn't overtly seductive, but was enough to make the politician think about it. I trust we will find time for a more productive discussion soon, Barton. Soon indeed, Desiree. The senator leaned in toward her, but she pulled away first, somehow managing to look like she was driven by haste, and not pure revulsion for the Confed politician. Mariellis was willing to do whatever was necessary to complete the mission, but if things went that way, she'd need to make sure she had an anti-emetic on hand. She wasn't sure how much of her disgust was a reaction to Farrell's physical unattractiveness, and how much to the sheer idiocy he spewed every time his mouth opened. For now, she would get what she could through pure verbal manipulation. She'd worry about taking things further later if and when it became absolutely necessary. She turned and walked down the path parallel to the river. She did have other work to do. That at least was the truth. Farrell wasn't even a significant part of her original mission, but his position as vice chairman of the committee overseeing Confederation intelligence made him an ideal asset for her new secondary operation. Her efforts to subvert the Confederation government had been going well, but by any measure it was still a long-term plan, one of gradual destabilization. Turning the Senate on Gary Holston, that was child's play by comparison, especially since half the sitting members of the body had engaged in past tiffs with a spy. She knew Holston had his own ways of keeping the Senate off his back, and after meeting so many of the august body's members, she could only imagine the grotesqueries which had ended up in the Confed Intelligence Chief's private files. The list of those in that dossier included Farrell, no doubt, and overcoming the senator's fear of blowback from Holston was the trickiest part of her assignment. She was working Farrell, pushing him as hard as she dared, and supplying him with written complaints from business owners and citizens on Danith. Most of those were forged, but that was only because Holston had been smart enough to cut off most communication from the embargoed planet. That was a short-term game for Holston. It wouldn't keep things quiet long, and it only added to the actions that could be called abuse of power, but it would buy him some time. Mariellis had never minded lying to complete a mission. In fact, she didn't particularly differentiate between the truth and falsehoods. She thought more in terms of what those involved needed to hear, and she gave them that. She'd learned realities in her career that most people never managed to completely understand. A well-crafted, believable lie, for example, could be far safer and more useful than an unprovable truth. People constantly ruin themselves chasing after concepts of fairness and justice that didn't exist. She had long ago promised herself she would never be one of them. She had an insurance policy on the Danith operation as well, a backup for the unreliable senator's efforts. She'd assured Farrell that everything she'd given him was confidential, and she'd promised to wait, to hold it all and let him proceed his own way. Then she'd almost immediately made sure all the information was leaked to the media and to half the other senators in Troia City. None of it could be traced to her, of course. At least she was pretty sure of that. But if Farrell didn't move quickly, or if he allowed Holston's dirty little file to deter him, he would be forced to take action when he started seeing news reports on the vid about the Danith blockade. She'd even managed to line up some protests to start the next day, mostly professional rabble-rousers who turned out to be quite a bit cheaper and easier to find on Megara than she'd expected. The events on Danith were unrelated to her Operation Black Dawn, but there was some potential crossover. If she could get Holston in real trouble, perhaps even suspended from his role as head of the intelligence agency, it would wreak havoc on Confed counterintelligence efforts, just as she was putting Black Dawn into its final stages. And if Holston fought back as aggressively as she suspected he would, the Confederation Senate would descend into an orgy of scandal and infighting. The perfect setting for Black Dawn. The plan to destabilize the Confederation was enormously complex, and there were countless ways it could be thwarted. Holston in prison and his closest operatives scrambling for cover would create the perfect opportunity and eliminate a good number of the potential sources of failure. Marielis knew quite well the rewards that would await her back on Mont Morale if she succeeded. She looked behind her, just a quick check to make sure she was out of Farrell's sight, and then she stopped, turning again toward the river. It meandered from the government district through a neighborhood of exclusive shops and finally to the base of Lantern Hill, where most of the senators and the highly paid lobbyists, including at least one fake one herself, kept apartments. She'd come to Troia's city on a mission, but she still found herself surprised by its pleasantness and beauty. The metropolis outshone even Liberté's city on Mont Morale, and by several orders of magnitude. She knew the capital was where the highest ranked of the elites were, and that the average Confed citizen never saw anything even remotely comparable to the wonders of Troyes. She was also well aware that many of the worlds of the Confederation's Iron Belt were industrial hells, populated by workers little better off than those of the Union. But still, there was little doubt in her mind now that the average Confed lived a much better life than the near sustenance-level existence of the vast majority of the Union citizens. And she understood even more acutely the importance of the propaganda machine that kept that information from the masses back home. The same reality was one big reason why the Union had been unable to defeat its foe, she realized. For all the corruption and the poverty she knew existed on many worlds, most Confederation citizens felt some level of genuine patriotism. They believed their lives were better than they would be in another nation, and certainly in a place like the Union. The equivalent sentiment in the Union was a pale imitation, driven by blatant and repeated propaganda, and enforced by the death squads of Sector 9, now the People's Protectorate. Another person might have come to the conclusion that she was on the wrong side, that the Union was evil and the Confederation was good. Perhaps, for just a few seconds, something of the sort danced on the outskirts of her thoughts. But she was a creature of the Union, and she recognized where her path to wealth and power lay. She'd been a successful operative, and save for the past year and a half, she'd lived quite well on the fruits of her victories. She had long ago eradicated any weakness or moral quandaries that could interfere with the ruthlessness her own success required, and she recognized the importance of her current work. This was the true opportunity, the one that would lead her to the upper levels of the People's Protectorate, and potentially farther, perhaps to whatever body eventually replaced the old Presidium. She smiled as she panned her eyes down the riverbanks, scanning one magnificent building after another. The Confederation was strong, there was no doubt about that. It had proven to be too mighty to defeat economically or militarily. But there were more ways to gain a victory, to destroy an enemy. Now she was going to kill it from the inside like a deadly cancer, invading its vital areas and destroying them one by one. She would exploit their political divisions, use their corruption and decadence against them. She would turn them in on each other and watch them topple their own institutions in a mad frenzy to destroy each other. The Confederation's weakness was arrogance. They saw the troubles of nations all around them, civil war in the Alliance, revolution in the Union, and they believed such things couldn't happen to them. She would show them they were wrong, that they were not immune to the sorts of upheavals that shook the other nations. She would bring them the Black Dawn. Chapter 27. Planet Zero, Z-11 System, Year 315 AC. I need more samples. I don't care if you have to chase the locals through the woods and hold them down, but it has to be now. Stu Weldon was Dauntless's chief medical officer, a position he'd held since the day Tyler Barron had taken command of the old Dauntless, and one he'd refused to give up, even when it had moved to a new ship bearing the name. Even when Barron had bumped him up in rank and gave him the added post of top sawbones of the entire fleet. "Yes, Dr. Weldon." The assistant turned and raced off, away from the med pod Weldon was leaning over and out the small doorway of the hut. The shacks were filthy and dark, extremely poor raw material for a makeshift hospital. But they were all Weldon had, at least until the Marines finished putting up the prefab structures Baron had sent down from the fleet. Weldon didn't like the readings on the pod. He didn't like them at all. Whatever was afflicting the landing party, and the number of victims had grown to over 70 now, nothing he'd tried had been even partially effective in slowing the progression of the disease. He'd started reviewing readings and data transmitted up to the fleet until he'd thrown his hands in the air at the difficulty of long-range analysis and stated unequivocally that he was going to the surface and that no one was going to stop him. Baron tried, at least, but the Admiral's legendary stubbornness had once more met its match in that of his chief surgeon. In the end, Baron had relented. Mostly, Weldon suspected, because Baron knew it was the best chance of getting somewhere on addressing the growing epidemic. He hadn't lost any of the patients yet, but that was just because he'd put the worst of them in partial cryostasis. That number had risen to more than 24, and it had challenged the Marines and fleet support personnel hastily building infrastructure to keep up with his needs. The med pods used a fair amount of energy under normal circumstances, but activating the cryo systems really turned them into electricity hogs. The landing party was still on battery power, and was going through fresh units as quickly as Baron could get more down to the surface. The Admiral had finally sent a portable fusion reactor, but moving something like that with shuttles required massive disassembly, and the corresponding need to put the thing back together. That was a complex job, especially when it was mostly a bunch of Marines working on it, following directions sent down from the engineering team on Dauntless. Weldon suspected many of the fleet's experts had volunteered to come to the surface, but he was just as certain Baron wasn't going to let anyone else down, not unless it was absolutely vital. Weldon had managed to come to a few conclusions. First, whatever was afflicting the landing party, it was highly contagious, far more than any disease he'd ever seen. It could be transmitted by contact with the skin, even through clothing of a moderately protective nature. Anything short of sealed spacesuits did little to prevent the disease from infecting another host. He'd come to a related conclusion, one he'd kept to himself, mostly because it would serve no purpose to pass it on. Its dissemination would only cause a panic and cripple the ongoing work to get the landing party's infrastructure in place. But he was sure now, at least as certain as he could be. The pathogen at work was not natural. It had been engineered. It was a weapon. Dr. Weldon. He turned his head and looked back toward the doorway. It was one of the other doctors, and he knew immediately from her tone what she was going to say. We've had our first fatality. Jake, thank you for coming. I imagine you're tired, and I'm sure another debriefing of sorts is the last thing you wanted to deal with right now. Baron stood up and walked around his desk, reaching out and shaking his chief pilot's hand. Of course, Admiral, I've never been the best at obeying orders, I guess, but there isn't a man or woman in uniform I respect more than you. It seemed odd to Stockton that Baron would thank him for coming, but then he caught the creases on the Admiral's face, the dark circles around his eyes. He was sure he wasn't privy to everything that was going on. Though he'd picked up enough to know the landing parties were stuck down on the planet, that Baron wasn't even allowing the resupply ships to land. He didn't know exactly what was happening, but he was sure it wasn't good. Now that he saw Baron's face up close, he understood just how much pressure the Admiral was carrying around, and that meant things were even worse than he'd thought. Probably much worse. I appreciate that, Jake. It's a great comfort to me to have you in charge of our squadrons. You've fought it at times, but the truth is, you're a natural leader. And no one I've ever met knows better than you just what a pack of lightnings can do. Thank you, sir. Jake forced a smile, but he found that Baron's stress was contagious. He'd seen the Admiral face impossible situations before, but he'd never seen him look as lost as he did just then. Please, Jake, sit. Baron gestured toward one of the chairs, and he moved back around the desk, dropping hard into his seat. Stockton nodded and did the same, but he remained silent, looking across at Baron, waiting to see what he had to say. Why he'd been called to the Admiral's office. Jake, I wanted to talk with you about those satellites. I read your report and the reports of the other pilots involved in the operations, but I wanted to be sure I understood everything. A pause. It's important we have a good idea of what's happening, what may be coming. Well, sir, I don't know what I can tell you that wasn't in the reports. I picked up the signals, and the best I could get reads on them, they were heading to one of the transit points, the one we've designated as Point Delta. Everyone seems convinced it was some kind of comm signal. Baron leaned back in his chair. The prevailing guess is those things were part of some kind of still-functioning ancient Imperial communication system. much the same as the thoughts on the satellites we found in the previous systems. Stockton could tell from Barron's tone the Admiral was far from convinced the prevailing wisdom was correct, which was good because Stockton didn't believe for a second those devices were old tech artifacts. The positioning was highly suspect, for one thing. The locations almost too perfect within the debris fields. Debris fields that didn't exist when Imperials would have placed them in orbit.
I don't especially agree with those findings, sir.
You think someone else put them there?
Yes, Admiral, but I have no idea who it could have been.
I believe I do, Jake. Barron stared across the desk, his eyes fixed on Stockton's.
Admiral?
The pilot returned the gaze, but he doubted he'd kept the confusion out of his expression.
I'm going to tell you something, Jake. What's going on down on the surface? What I tell you here is not to leave this room.
Barron paused.
I'm afraid I'm going to need the best everyone has to offer in the coming days and weeks, and that includes you and your pilots. We came here as explorers, but I'm afraid we found something far more dangerous than we'd expected, and I'm not sure what to do.
Barron hesitated again, and then he filled Stockton in on everything that had happened on the planet.
I want some answers from you.
Weldon stared at the captive, his determination fueled by frustration over his inability to make any real progress on treating those afflicted by the epidemic.
You are a medical professional, are you not?
The prisoner's every word dripped with arrogance. The emphasis he'd placed on the word professional was clearly derisive, something even the translation AI had managed to reconstruct as it repeated the master's response for Weldon.
Yes, I am, Weldon replied, keeping his voice even. You are no doubt among the most capable and intelligent of your expedition. You are clearly at a high range of capabilities among the inferiors. Why don't you tell me what you believe is happening to your people?
The master seemed calmer than he had before, as though he'd adapted to his situation. He still showed no signs of fear, but he seemed more amused than he had before.
Okay, I'll play your game. Obviously there is a pathogen on this world, one my people have never been exposed to and for which they have little resistance. It is indeed a display of your weakness, of the inferiority of your people. Disease affects all people, especially a virulent agent like this one.
Weldon found himself more affected by the prisoner's barbs than he'd expected to be.
Does it? I am 63 Imperial years old.
The AI couldn't translate the next term the master used precisely. It offered dog and vermin as close substitutes.
I have never been what you would call sick, such as the fate of inferiors, the Kriegeri and Arbiter, and of course those who inhabit this world.
He paused, clearly finding the whole thing amusing.
Yet even the defects who work the mines here are immune from that which is destroying your people.
Weldon felt another angry response to the man's words, but it was deflected by the master's disclosure of his age. He didn't look a day over 30, and none of the scans the med teams had managed to conduct without actually examining the subject suggested anything different. He'd known the master's genetic makeup showed few weaknesses, but he still found himself shocked at the practical effects of the man's DNA, in terms of apparent intellect, and now aging as well.
I need you to tell me everything you know about this disease. Is it familiar to you?
Weldon tried to push the revelation about the master's age from his mind and focus on what he needed to know. Controlling the epidemic was the most important problem he faced.
Why would I do that, inferior? You have taken me prisoner, exhibited the audacity to treat me without asking permission, denied me the respect one of your level owes to one of mine. I need only wait here until all of you are dead, and then I will again be free. The defects would not dare to hold me against my will, even though you have slain all my Kriegeri.
We have an entire fleet in orbit with— Weldon caught himself. He was far from sure he should be sharing any information about the fleet with a prisoner. The master was captive, of course, but it was beginning to look very much like his people would become enemies.
With enough resources to send more people down to the surface.
Unlikely, you have discovered, I suspect, despite your primitive science and limited analytical capacity. The master managed to make the insult sound matter-of-fact, like the declaration of an inarguable reality. That the agent at work is quite difficult to keep at bay, even with protective clothing and life support. Would your fleet and whoever is in command risk sending more of your people to the surface? Even fully contained environmental suits would pose tremendous risks. The virus, and yes, it is a highly engineered virus you are facing, was designed to facilitate contagion. It is capable of surviving considerable periods in space, even radiation-based decontamination procedures, and it reproduces rapidly.
A very small number, even a single virus surviving on an environmental suit, is likely to kill everyone on whatever ship it is brought aboard. The Master paused and looked at Weldon, his expression something akin to a smile. No, your commander will not dare to land more people to the surface, nor allow any of you already here to leave, so all I need to do is wait. Are you suggesting all of us will die? Weldon wasn't as surprised as he imagined he sounded. He'd already considered the possibility of 100% infection. He could call Bairn for spacesuits, for life support habitats, but it wouldn't do much good. Everyone on the surface had already been exposed. Ah, you come to face the inevitable consequences of your own inferiority. You do seem to have some rudimentary intelligence, and some familiarity with tools and weapons of moderate technological complexity, but you lack the ability to resist the disease. It is called the Plague, by the way, and it was employed during the Troubles. Weldon wasn't sure what the Master meant by Troubles, but he suspected it was what was known as the Cataclysm among the Rim Nations. You consider that an inferiority? Vulnerability to a disease designed to kill billions? Do I appear to be infected or even concerned? I am wearing no protective gear. The Master smiled, a grin that unsettled Weldon. Even the defects, near animals that they are immune. Yet your people are dying, such is the curse of your genetic frailty. Of course, that is inferiority. Nothing measures a being more than his or her genetic makeup. Your DNA has allowed you to master limited levels of technology, to imagine yourselves as something special in the universe, the top of your own small hill, so to speak. But now you see the true weakness of your people, and you have found your betters, your masters. Weldon struggled to hold back a burst of rage. He was astonished how effortlessly the Master could provoke him without so much as raising his voice. But the discussion, frustrating as the prisoner could be, had not been in vain. Weldon knew he faced an uphill struggle in defeating the weaponized disease, but there was something useful in what the prisoner had said. Even the people he referred to as defects, clearly the unfortunate descendants of people who'd suffered terrible mutations, seemed to be immune. Of course, they're all the descendants of survivors. All those who weren't naturally immune died out long ago. He stood up, turning to leave the small hut. I will pity your death, inferior. Among your rabble, you seem to be among the most capable. You would have made a fitting servant. Weldon ignored the taunt. He didn't have time to argue with the prisoner. He could feel the itchiness, the discomfort on his arms and legs, the first symptoms of the disease. He'd have to confirm it with a medical scan, but he didn't have the slightest doubt it would confirm he was infected. He had work to do, and not much time left. Bairn sat on Dauntless's bridge, which was what he still called the battleship's immense fleet control center. He was watching the members of his command crew at their posts, but his thoughts were with his people on the surface, with the prisoner and the strange natives of the planet, and with fruitless imaginings of what his fleet had found in the system. What lay out there, closer to the Empire's old core? What expectations when the fleet left Megara had been based on finding old tech, and perhaps better information on the history of the Cataclysm? Now he knew that history included other survivors, and that some of those at least were dangerous. He didn't know where that would lead, but the tightness he'd had in his gut for 2 straight days told him his instincts didn't expect anything good to come of it at all. He hadn't spent much time at the communication station over the past few days. He'd classified everything that was happening on the surface at the highest levels, tried to keep as much as he could from spreading through the fleet. That had relegated him to his office, where he could have a degree of privacy unavailable in the control center, but now he realized most of those efforts had been pointless. It was hard to keep secrets in an outfit like the White Fleet, and even more so when he was stripping ships of med pods and imposing seemingly bizarre rules on the shuttles supplying the surface. He knew his people probably didn't know everything he did, but he was damn sure they knew something was wrong. He was thinking about making a fleet-wide announcement, one that would explain all that had happened. He was about to order the comm officer to set up a line when Sonya Eaton turned toward him. Admiral, we're getting a transmission from the probes at Transit Point Delta. He turned and looked at his aide. What is it, Captain? Energy spike, sir. It looks like we have ships transiting and about to enter the system. Bairn felt as though he'd had the wind knocked out of him. There was no chance any Confederation vessels were coming through that point, none at all, and that meant, Bring the fleet to battle stations, Captain. Prepare to scramble fighter squadrons on my order. Yes, Admiral. Eaton was one of the very few privy to everything that was happening on the planet. She seemed calm, though Baron suspected that was an exercise in self-control and not any absence of fear and tension she was feeling. He looked at the display, watching, waiting, even as Dauntless's battle station's lamps bathed the entirety of the Great Control Center in a soft red glow. He was still focused on the display, when ships started coming through the point, one after the other. Chapter 28 CFS Dauntless, Orbiting Planet Zero, Z-11 System, Year 315 AC. No further transits, Admiral. 14 ships total. The four in the front appear to have greater masses and densities as well as significantly higher energy outputs. If I had to guess, I'd say they were warships of some kind, probably escorts for the others. Baron nodded, but didn't respond. Sonya Eaton was serving her own role and shouldering much of the burden of commanding Dauntless, and she was doing a magnificent job by any objective standard. But she failed in one critical area. She wasn't Atara Travis. He knew he did Eaton a disservice by comparing her to Atara Travis, but he couldn't help it. Travis had been at his side in every desperate battle he'd fought, and the two had long been synced together as a team. He'd have sworn they'd communicated telepathically during those terrible fights, and he felt naked going into a situation as crucial and dangerous as this one without her on the bridge. All ships are to remain at battle stations and hold their positions. No one is to fire or launch fighters without my express orders. Yes, Admiral. The warrior inside Baron was screaming to deploy his ships for battle, to advance until his primaries were in range, and certainly to get his squadrons launched and ready for battle. But he wasn't just Admiral Baron now. He was the Confederation's ambassador to a new and mysterious power. His actions, or inactions, could prevent a war. Or start one against an enemy that was almost a total mystery. But the only thing he knew was they had superior technology. Were they as big as the Confederation? Just a few systems. Or 10 times the size of all the Rim Nations combined. His nerves were raw and his thoughts drifted to the reports on the interrogation of the prisoner. The man's attitude didn't support a conclusion that whoever was in those approaching ships was friendly. But whatever chance there was to prevent hostilities, he knew he had to take it. Updated scans, Admiral. It definitely appears the lead vessels are warships. The AI has identified the other 10 as freighters of some kind. Very well, Captain. Of course, it all started to make sense, and to match the reports he'd gotten from the surface. Those people on the ground, the ones they call defects, they work the mines, and these ships are here to pick up the ore and drop off some token goods in return. That's how the natives have clothing that's manufactured. Baron thought about it as trade, but only for a few seconds. It wasn't anything close to legitimate commerce. The masters, whoever they were, ruled over the inhabitants of the planet, using technology to set themselves up almost as gods to be worshipped and obeyed. And they sent the locals into the mines without proper equipment or protective gear, giving them tokens like cheap clothing and manufactured food products in return for the priceless ores their sweat and blood produced. The defects are expendable to them. They don't care how many die in the mines as long as the ore flows. He shook his head. He found the whole thing to be reprehensible, but the more he thought of the prisoner's attitude, of his casual, almost natural feelings of superiority, he began to see the perverse logic in it all. They think of these people as animals, or at least something very close to that. He took a deep breath. That explained everything. The pyramid was a command post of sorts, to keep an eye on the locals and make sure they were keeping up with their production quotas. Any failure, any resistance, could be easily punished by sending out a few of the soldier types, the Kriegeri, and massacring as many as it took to restore obedience. They probably didn't have to do even that very often. A light show or something around the pyramid would probably be enough to dazzle and terrify the locals. His realization only dragged down his mood. The people he was describing to himself didn't seem to be good material for likely allies, or even benevolent neighbors. Deep down, Baron knew his people faced a fight. But still, he couldn't start it. He had to stay the course, hope beyond hope for a peaceful solution. Put me on a line to the lead and a... unidentified ship. Patch in translation AI set for High Imperial. Baron actually spoke a little of the ancient Imperial tongue, a benefit of the eclectic education he'd received as the scion of a wealthy and powerful family. But he didn't think his patchy and rough attempts at getting a message across in the old language were likely to aid the cause of diplomacy. You're live, Admiral. AI active. Attention approaching vessels. He second-guessed himself, wondered if his tone was too hard-sounding. This is Admiral Tyler Baron, commander of the White Fleet. We are representatives of the Stellar Confederation and the Palatian Alliance on a peaceful mission of exploration. We have no hostile intent, and if we have encroached on your space, it was purely by accident. He sat in his chair, bolt upright and as tense as he'd ever been. A response now could open the road to peace, or start a war right then and there. There was nothing. Silence. This is not good. Baron sat still, his eyes darting from one side to the other, watching the crew of the control center at their posts. There was no chatter, no sound save those from the equipment. He felt as though he were falling, as if a darkness had come to take him. His grandfather was the hero of the Second Union War, the man the history texts say saved the Confederation. And I will go down in history as the one who went out and found a deadly new enemy. Another war and countless more dead. Suddenly the comm unit crackled. A voice blared out, firm, cold. Attention invaders! You have entered the space of the hegemony. This is an act of war. You will yield at once, power down your ships and prepare to be boarded, or you will be destroyed. Baron was struck by the casual sense of superiority evident in every syllable uttered by the speaker. He was stunned as well by the sheer audacity on display. These people, the hegemony apparently, did seem to possess superior technology, but could they possibly think their four warships could take on the entire White Fleet? It seemed absurd. Could they be so certain of their own superiority? Baron couldn't imagine the kind of confidence run wild that could fuel such an attitude. But he knew if these people wanted a fight, they would get one. Almost every man and woman in his fleet was a veteran of 6 bloody years of war. They had seen friends die, stood to their posts in the midst of battle, faced enemy forces that outnumbered and outgunned them. To Baron's way of thinking, no 4 ships in the universe could defeat his fleet. He reached up to his headset and flipped the small switch, activating the transmitter. "I repeat," he said, knowing in his gut there was no point. "We are not invaders. We are peaceful explorers, and our encroachment into your space was accidental. You have 30 seconds to surrender, inferior. Then you will be destroyed." There wasn't a bit of hesitation in the voice. Baron turned toward Eaton. "All ships are to hold position. If there's going to be a fight here, we're not going to start it. All squadrons are to prepare for launch, but they will remain in the tubes until I give the order. Understood?" "Yes, Admiral." Eden activated her own headset and transmitted Baron's orders. He looked up at the display, wondering if the hegemony commander was bluffing, or if he'd so casually start a war against people that had to be as much a mystery to him as he and his were to Baron. He wanted to believe it was posturing, that a commander of such a small force wouldn't take that kind of step against a superior force that offered peace. He wanted to believe that, but he didn't. His eyes were fixed on the approaching ships. They were still several light seconds away, a good bit out of range even of Baron's primaries. They hadn't launched any fighters yet, and he wondered how they would make good on their threat when they were still so far out. He didn't have to wait long for his answer. His eyes were fixed on the chronometer and the 30-second countdown Eaton had activated when the hegemony officer made his threat. It was moving down. 3, 2, 1. Nothing happened, not for a few seconds. Then the screen lit up, energy readings from the approaching ships almost off the charts. Eden spun around, and Baron could see in her eyes what he just caught on his screen. "It's formidable, sir. She's been hit by some kind of beam. Captain Fitzgerald reports heavy damage." Baron's eyes were still on the screen. Even as Eden reported on formidable, 2 more of his ships took hits. 2 things hit Baron like a sledgehammer. First, his people were at war again. And second, the enemy's guns massively outranged his own fleet's weaponry. Atara Travis walked across the open space in the center of the village. It was a common of some sort, she imagined, though exactly what the small, muddy section of ground was good for eluded her. She found it difficult to accept that people actually lived the way the natives did, without any technology, save for the mining tools and rough clothes the masters deigned to supply to their... She didn't finish the thought, but her anger flared anyway. She'd come from the bottom rungs of society, and she'd known poverty so intense that she'd rummage through garbage for something to eat. But the idea of allowing people, victims of a war fought centuries before, to exist in such a primitive state, digging with hand tools through radioactive mines until the exposure killed them, fueled her growing anger, even hatred, for the people who called themselves masters. She turned and glanced back to the hut where their prisoner from that group sat quietly, engaging in short discussions with the various experts trying to learn more about him. She tried to imagine a shipful of such people, an entire fleet. Travis was frustrated. She understood Baron's orders and the reasons for them, but part of her wanted to grab the obnoxious fool and beat all the information they needed from him. He'd been rude and arrogant in verbal exchanges, but he hadn't given up any information the teams hadn't already known. She wondered how someone with such a high opinion of his standing would hold up under a real interrogation. She'd fought the Union for years, learned to hate them with a passion, but she occasionally envied them the unrestrained tools at their disposal. Sector 9 wouldn't put up with this piece of shit and his nonsense. They'd throw him on a rack, and he'd be lucky if his refusals to submit to a medical exam didn't get him dissected. The usual crowd of villagers was gathered around the hut. They hadn't dared to try to rescue the master. No doubt they think we're some kind of rival gods and they're afraid to provoke us too. But they remained outside the makeshift prison, chanting and singing and in between, looking generally mournful. Watching the people practically worshipping beings who left them in such a pathetic state was throwing fuel on the fire of her anger. She'd have called Baron and done her best to argue for more aggressive methods, except she understood the same thing he did. Any wrong move could easily drag the Confederation into a new war against an unknown and apparently very advanced enemy. If there's any way to avoid that now. Travis tended toward the pessimistic, and as she thought about it, she realized she had already decided war was inevitable. She just wasn't sure she'd last long enough to fight it. The infection rate from the virus seemed to be 100%, or something very close to it. Most of the landing party was showing symptoms, and she figured that she had 2 days, maybe 3, before she wouldn't have any Marines left standing to guard the prisoner or the shuttles. She watched helplessly as everyone around her fell sick, first with the relatively minor early symptoms, and then fever and delirium, before they finally ended up in cryostasis, and for 37 of them so far, death. But she was fine, at least so far. She hadn't had a sign of the disease, and except for some fatigue and stress, she felt great. She suspected it was a matter of time, and each day she expected the onset of symptoms. But the days passed, and she remained healthy, even as the people around her got sicker and sicker. Doc Weldon was still on his feet, though she knew he shouldn't be. Weldon was sick, his body ravaged by the deadly disease. She didn't dare to think about what variety of drugs and in what massive doses he injected himself to keep moving. The long-term effects of such heavy dosing had to be considerable, but she supposed that didn't matter if there was no long-term. Weldon was the best candidate to find a cure, and when he finally lapsed into the coma that had taken so many others, it would pretty much seal the fate of the rest of the landing party. The scientists on the fleet were working around the clock, too, but Weldon was incredibly gifted, and he was on site. If he couldn't find a solution, it was doubtful anyone else would, at least not quickly enough. The doctor still aboard ships might figure the whole thing out eventually, but that would be far, far too late.
Captain Travis, we just got to communicate from Dauntless.
The officer's voice was shrill, and it didn't take much listening for Travis to realize the news wasn't good.
What is it?
She said, letting more of her frustration slip into her tone than she'd intended.
There are 2 ships entering the system from Transit Point Delta. They've attacked the fleet.
Travis moved toward the officer, and the hut the landing party had turned into a makeshift comm center. She had to get as many details as she could. Not that she could do anything about anything. Travis was a fighter, and her place was on Dauntless as the ship, her ship, went into a fight. The frustration hitting her was intense, almost overwhelming. The war she'd expected had come, and she was stuck down on a shithole planet, wallowing in the mud and waiting for a deadly plague to take her, while her people, her ship, Tyler, went into battle. All ships are to advance at maximum thrust. Baron snapped out the order almost instinctively. The enemy weapons were longer range than his own, and they had surprising hitting power, even so far out. His ships were sitting ducks at this distance. He was used to having the range advantage, and he knew exactly how well it could be used, even by an outnumbered force. He had to get them into primary range, now.
Yes, Admiral, all ships maximum thrust.
He leaned back, expecting the usual hard push from the thrusters. He was still surprised every time Dauntless's upgraded force dampeners kicked in and absorbed most of even the ship's massive maximum thrust. The new units were not only stronger than the old ones, cutting out as much as 12G of force, they were faster, too. The old ones always kicked in late, which meant a couple seconds of enduring the full force of the engines. Now it was an almost imperceptible delay, one that manifested as a strange feeling that was already gone by the time the brain processed it. His eyes darted to the display every few seconds. The enemy ships. He'd been correcting himself every time he'd called them that, but there seemed little point now. It fired only their first volley. That gave him some hope. Their weapons were longer range than his, and they seemed to have more hitting power, too, a problem that would probably become more severe once the ships were closer. But it also looked like they needed time to recharge before firing again. Fleet order. All squadrons launch. Acknowledged, Admiral. All squadrons launch. Eden repeated his order on the fleet comm, and no more than a few seconds later, Dauntless shook gently, the effect of the distant launch catapult sending his ship's fighters into space. He imagined Stockton had been the first one out, or damned close to it, and he would have bet his fighter commander was already on the comm, badgering the launch crews on the other ships to pick up the pace. Commanding Stockton hadn't always been an easy job, but Baron was pleased to see how his wild fighter jock had matured into his command position. He knew Stockton hated it, at least on some levels, but he was certain the legendary Raptor would get better performance from his fighters than anyone else could. He was legend, to young pilots and veterans, and Baron knew they would follow him anywhere. Even into the unknown to fight a new enemy.
All ships report launch operations underway, sir.
A short pause.
Dauntless Launch Control reports all squadrons launched, Admiral.
Baron turned toward the display just as the enemy ships opened up with their second barrage. Formidable took another hit, and he could see from the reports streaming down his screen that the battleship had taken considerable damage. Her thrust was down to 60%, and it looked like she was experiencing sporadic power outages. Another two of his ships had also been impacted by the long-range beams. The enemy was scoring hits with roughly half their shots, which was an astonishing rate at such a long range.
All ships increase evasive maneuvering. Institute Nav Plan Beta 2.
Nav Plan Beta 2, sir.
He designed Beta 2 himself. It cut the effect of forward acceleration of his ship somewhat, but it would give the enemy AI something to think about and maybe reduce the effectiveness of their targeting. He watched as the range counted down. The enemy fired a third time and then a fourth. His evasive maneuvers had helped, cutting the enemy's accuracy to less than 25%. He wondered if that would last or if the targeting computers out there were sophisticated enough to adjust. He wasn't going to take that chance.
All ships, switch to Nav Plan Beta 2.
Yes, Admiral.
Baron felt Dauntless lurch hard as the new Nav Plan took effect. He didn't have many rookies aboard Dauntless, or anywhere in the fleet for that matter, but he suspected the ones he did have would see their stomachs put to the test by the wild gyrations. Possibly some of the old-timers, too. He reached out and put his hands on the chair's armrest, an instinctive reaction to the ship's heart bouncing. His eyes remained focused on the range counter.
All ships reduce forward thrust to 30%. Arm primaries.
Yes, sir.
The fleet was almost in range. The primary batteries were energy hogs, and he had to cut thrust to get them charged. The guns were potent, perhaps not quite as strong as the enemy's weapons appeared to be, but they would send the message they were intended to send. Whoever was out there might call themselves masters, but they weren't the only ones who knew how to fight, and they didn't have any monopoly on deadly weapons either. Baron watched the chronometer and the rangefinder. One by one, the comms came in from the fleet, his ships reporting their primaries were armed and ready. Baron's eyes were fixed on the display, watching as the range dropped. He waited as the numbers slipped into the range band of the primaries. He paused a few more seconds, counting down from the last enemy shot, getting as close as he could before the attackers fired again. Then he turned toward Eaton and nodded.
Captain, all ships fire.
Chapter 29. PUV Carcajou, approaching Baru. Re-Ann System, Union Year 219-315 AC.
All ships report weapons fully charged and ready to engage, Admiral.
Andre Denisov sat in his command chair, trying with all his ability to look calm, ready. He was a veteran, one of the few Union officers who distinguished himself in the disastrous war against the Confederation. He'd always been a confident commander, cool and professional under fire. But he'd never led more than a single ship in battle. He appreciated the massive promotion Gaston Villeneuve had given him, but now he was worried it had taken him too far, too fast. He had 24 vessels under his command, about to go into what he knew would be a vicious fight. And that didn't count the huge armada of transports on the other side of the transit point, waiting to invade Baru after his fleet blasted the orbital defenses to scrap. He stared at the screen in front of him, at the scanning data scrolling slowly by. He'd sent in a cloud of probes to back up his ship's sensors, and now he was getting his first good read on the planet's defenses. The fortresses were there, as he knew they would be. And something else, too. Small contacts clustered between the orbital forts. It took a while to get a solid read on what they were, some kind of laser platforms or buoys. That was unexpected, and it meant Baru had a lot more firepower than he'd expected, and he'd already been worried about the forts. He felt the urge to withdraw, to return to Mont Morale and report that the rebels had somehow increased the planet's fortifications, and they were now too strong to assault without a much stronger force. But no stronger force was available, nor would they be for quite some time. And Gaston Villeneuve wanted Baru pacified, now. It was likely just as dangerous, and maybe more so, to return home empty-handed as to take a chance and assault the planet's defenses. "The fleet is to institute maximum evasive maneuvers, starting now." His ships were still out of range of the fortress guns, and a quick review of the mass of the laser buoy suggested they would have a somewhat shorter target zone. But he wasn't taking any chances. Anyway he looked at it, his fleet was going to pay a heavy price, and whatever he could do to lessen the damage until his ships were in range was worthwhile. There was no choice. They had to go in, and that meant there was no point worrying about anything but attacking with all the skill and ferocity he could dredge up. "All ships increase thrust to maximum. We're going in."
"We've got to do something, Mike. We can't be a part of this. These people are worse than the Union. My God, they're more brutal than Sector 9.
Mike Hoover sat quietly, listening to Sylvia Breen. She was upset, and he thought it might help her to get it all off her chest. It was the least he could do, because he knew what she truly wanted was out of reach. "Syl," he finally said, his voice as calm as he could manage, "you know our orders and you know why we're here. Caron and his people are reprehensible, but we didn't come to liberate the workers of Baru. We're here to put a thorn in the Union's side, and that's our only concern." He didn't feel good about what he was saying. He was as torn and guilty about aiding such ruthless totalitarians as Breen. But that didn't change their orders, or the fact that there was little or nothing they could do to interfere, even if they wanted to.
"So that's it? We're just following orders? Do you think Director Holston would even want us to prop up such a horrific regime if he knew the truth?"
Hoover didn't answer the question. He knew Holston better than Breen did, and he'd served him for longer. He didn't know what the Director of Confederation Intelligence would do or say if he'd been there, but he was far from sure Holston would have changed anything. The Confederation had been fighting the Union for a century, and millions had died in those recurring conflicts. It was hard to see the workers of Baru so victimized. But Hoover knew his allegiance, and Breen's, belonged to the Confederation and its people first and foremost. And he was sure that was exactly what Gary Holston would have told them if he'd been there. Finally, Hoover looked over at his number two. "Syl, I understand how you feel. I feel that way too. But what exactly do you think we could do for these splinter rebels even if we wanted to? Assisting Caron and his killers with holding Baru helps the Confederation. It preserves the peace, or at least extends it. Nothing we can do for Bernard and his people is going to change a thing here. We don't have troops, we don't have any significant cache of weapons, we don't even have enough agents to conduct proper intelligence operations. If we tried to help the resistance, we'd only weaken the planet's defenses and blow our mission." Breen looked like she was going to argue again, but she just slouched backward and let out a long, loud breath.
"I know you're right, Mike, but this is the first time I've thought of myself as one of the bad guys."
Hoover didn't know what to say. She wasn't wrong, though perhaps her view was a bit naive. War was a deadly business, and while he knew Caron and his minions were evil to the core, he also had an idea how many of his own people had died in 4 wars against the Union. If helping Caron hold on to Baru a little longer did the Confederation some good, so be it. He felt sorry for the workers of Baru, but his own people came first. Always.
Besides, Beru wouldn't hold out forever, no matter what he and his people did. One day, the Foudre Rouge and Sector 9 would land, and Remy Caron and Amy Delacorte and the rest of his bloodthirsty mob would get theirs. Oh, yes. If he knew anything about Sector 9 or whatever they were calling themselves now, Caron and his cronies would get every bit of what was coming to them. René Valour moved slowly around the outside of the building, pressed against the cold masonry walls. He was one of Amy Delacorte's people, one of the first agents in her Protectors of the Revolution. He distinguished himself early, hunting down and disposing of more of the revolutionaries on the proscribed list than anyone else. Remy Caron had given the actual orders, but Valour had seen Delacorte's fingerprints all over the plan, even as he did his part to see it executed. And he saw her influence on Caron in this operation as well. He turned and glanced back behind him. He had a dozen and a half protectors with him, some experienced, others less so. The agency was still in its early stages, and the repeated purges to remove unreliables had slowed its growth. There were maybe 3 of the 18 he'd have chosen, given better selection. Ideally, he'd have worked alone, but that wasn't possible here. He knew that well enough. This job had to be done quickly and completely. He was here to kill the Confeds, all of them, and he didn't want to think of the consequences of failure, or even partial success. There couldn't be any survivors. Delacorte had been extremely clear about that, and he also had to make sure it looked like the fringe rebel groups had done it. Valour tended not to think about the politics behind the killings he handled, but it was impossible not to grasp the sensitivity of murdering a couple dozen Confeds. He reached down and pulled the small comm unit from his belt. He'd already signaled base, advising them his people were in position. Now he was waiting for the final go-ahead. He tightened the grip of his other hand around the old battered rifle. He had far better weapons back at headquarters, inheritances from the Union forces that had once ruled the planet, but he wasn't taking any chances on this mission. The splinter groups he intended to blame for the killings, at least for Confederation consumption once contact was re-established, generally had to make do with far less advanced weaponry. That meant his team had to make do with the junky garbage their intended scapegoats used. He moved forward a few steps, standing near an air vent. He could hear talking. The Confeds, he was sure, but he couldn't make out what anyone was saying. His general opinion on questions of whether to kill someone was, why not? There was no reason to take chances, and letting some go was always a chance. If a mistake was made, better to kill a few innocents than allow one problem to escape and become larger, more dangerous. But killing Confeds made even a stone-cold killer like him nervous. It was time. No, it was past time. He looked down at the small comm unit, raised the hand that held it up to his head, tapping his earpiece. There was a burst of static, but still nothing. On any other mission, he would have gone in anyway without confirmation, but taking out the Confeds was a heavier load than he wanted on his shoulders alone. He would wait. Another minute passed, then 2. He started to get edgy. Something is wrong. He turned again, looking back at his team. They were impatient too. They were in a back alley, but the delay was endangering the mission badly. All it would take was one drunk wandering into the alley, looking for a place to take a leak or sleep off a bender. Any noise could tip off the Confeds, and Valour didn't have the slightest doubt they could defend themselves given any warning at all. He was here for a quick mass execution, not to start a firefight. One Confed escaping and eluding pursuit long enough to get a message back home, and the consequences could be dire. He was about to give the order without confirmation, to wave his people forward and get the job done. Just as he extended his arm, his earpiece crackled loudly, and Amy Delacorte's voice filled his ears.
Abort! Repeat, abort! We're under attack by a Union fleet. Return to base at once. I repeat, abort!
Open fire, all ships! Denisov glared forward, eyes fixed on Karkajou's main screen. There was a smoky haze floating across the bridge, and his eyes were red, stinging. The orbital defenses had outranged his ships. That hadn't been a surprise. What had been unexpected was the strength of those installations. There were over 100 laser buoys supporting the bases, and they were tearing his ships apart. He watched as his vessels finally got to return fire. He'd ordered all batteries to focus on the forts. The lasers were just too small to effectively target at long range, but the buoys were ripping into his ships, doing as much damage as the fortresses. Possibly more.
He scanned the info streaming across the display, his eyes moving from one platform to another, trying to determine if one was the headquarters of the orbital forces. He couldn't explain all the added firepower, but he was still willing to bet that whoever was crewing those things were mostly novices, revolutionaries who had hurriedly figured out how to operate the planet's defense grid, perhaps aided by a few prisoners or turncoats from the original crews. His mind raced, wondering how he could turn inexperience against his adversaries. Even as he considered his options, Carcajou shook hard, and a shower of sparks flew across the bridge. He swung his head around, his eyes finding the overloaded panel. It wasn't a vital station, and none of his people on the bridge seemed to be injured. It would take another half minute at least for damage control reports to flow in from the rest of the ship. "This isn't going to work," he thought, just as he heard his bridge officers shout out a cheer. One of the forts had been bracketed between three of his approaching vessels, and a shot from one of them took it in a critical area. There had been a moderate explosion and a blast of escaping gas from one section of the hull, but now, perhaps half a minute later, the entire thing vanished in a thermonuclear explosion. The celebration was short-lived, however. Denisov's ships had taken a beating just getting into range, and now all the fire from the platforms and the laser buoys was blasting away at his entire fleet. The pair went first, in an explosion no less dramatic than that which had accompanied the fortress's demise. Then Guerrier sent out a code black transmission. The ship didn't disappear in the fury of a thermonuclear explosion, but there was no response to any efforts to communicate, nor any detectable energy output. Denisov knew that the ship was a wreck, and that her entire crew was likely dead. He watched as another of the fortresses succumbed, reduced to a lifeless hulk like Guerrier, a shattered and holed hull remaining in its place. His ships were targeting the laser buoys as the range decreased, and they'd taken down about 10 of the weapons, but the return fire was taking its toll. Denisov knew what defeat would mean. It had taken Villeneuve nearly 2 years to scrape up enough ships to mount a credible assault on the rebellious planet. He wasn't likely to be terribly understanding to an admiral who'd gotten that relentlessly assembled fleet shot to pieces with nothing to show for it all. But Denisov had always been very analytical, able to follow a battle moment by moment and project such things as loss ratios and expected damage rates forward. And that skill was telling him one thing, no matter how he tried to look at it. His force wasn't going to make it. They would damage the planet's defensive array, probably badly. But there would be enough of it left to repel the troop transports, and his ships would be spent, destroyed, or crippled. All the rebels needed to do was hang on to enough orbital strength to keep the troops from landing, and they would retain control of the planet, and of the factories they appeared to have somehow repurposed to build additional defenses. Worse, if he didn't pull out now, there would be no turning back. He could get his fleet out now, at least he thought he could, but he didn't have much time. Delaying even for a few minutes more would make a choice just as certainly as giving an order now.
"All ships, reverse thrust. The fleet is to withdraw."
There was a pause. Then his tactical officer responded, uncertainty in his voice.
Yes, sir.
Denisov wasn't the only one with an idea of how Gaston Villeneuve would respond to the fleet returning without completing its mission. But Denisov had no intention of heading back to Montmorel in failure and disgrace. A frontal assault wasn't going to get the job done, but that didn't mean there weren't other options. He had to find another way to cripple the enemy defenses, and the spark of an idea was forming in his mind. Villeneuve wanted the rebellion on Beru crushed, but Denisov knew the Union's ruler didn't particularly care about collateral damage. Even a lot of collateral damage. Chapter 30 100,000 kilometers from CFS Dauntless, Z-11 system, year 315 AC.
"Squadron leaders, you're responsible for keeping your people in formation. We've got four targets and we're going in one after another like a pile driver. Bombers on the inside, interceptors outside. These bastards haven't launched yet, but it could happen any second, so be ready for anything."
Stockton was in his cockpit, feeling edgy, even scared, but also disturbingly at home. He had rejoiced at the end of the Union War as enthusiastically as any spacer in the fleet, but sometime in the 2 years since, he'd come to accept that a part of him deep down craved war, even needed it. It was, in a sense, his natural habitat, and as much as he craved peace, he was out of place when he got it. There was nothing in the universe he did as well as killing people with his fighter. Nothing he would ever do as well. Four targets seemed like a pathetically small force for the hundreds of fighters he was leading, but he'd seen the enemy's weapons and the damage they were doing to the Confederation's largest and toughest battleships. He could only guess what their fighters could do, or what deadly close-in defenses those ships had ready to blast his ships to atoms. He shoved his arm to the side, angling his thrust to bring his ship around. He didn't have a place in the attacking formation, at least not a formal one. He was in command of the whole shooting match. He'd been the fleet's strike force commander since the expedition had left Megara,